Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandaisy.
And today we're going to be talking about the new slasher flick, Hellfest. Matt, how would you describe Hellfest?
I would describe it as the Houses October built with a budget. It's like the Houses October built is actually now a pair of pretty mediocre, the second one is kind of egregiously bad, found footage horror movies released in the past couple years that are, you know, just about scare-hungry teens going through haunted houses for about 90 minutes and then running afoul of actual murderers. Hellfest is that, but more in the spirit of an 80s slasher movie with one antagonist who plods along slowly and wears a themed mask.
And it's also, for what it's worth, it's not found footage like Houses October built. It's
no.
Conventional format.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I think that would...
That's my pithy summary, as non-judgmental as possible.
Yeah, I think that's pretty close. I'll go ahead and walk us through a plot synopsis. This film's plot is kind of... I don't know, virtually non-existent, really.
It's really just a barrage of spooks and haunts, you know, and jump scares. It's kind of a jump scare factory.
The film opens with an initial group of, I think, three teenage girls, as it turns out, completely unrelated to the main characters, who go through some kind of haunted house maze, and initially one of these girls is... not really impressed with the scares and just kind of tells this guy to fuck off, basically. And later she encounters this guy when she's off by herself in this haunted maze, and he just kind of stares at her and looms toward her, and finally she admits, okay, you're right, it's scary, are you happy now? But no, he is not yet satisfied. And he stabs her and then hangs her up with a bunch of fake bodies in one big room in this maze. And that's the opening of Hellfest. We get a title card after that. And following the title card, we meet the main crew, as it were, which is composed eventually of six people. It's
three couples.
Three couples. We have Natalie, who's, I guess, the main character insofar as there is a main character, who's meeting up with her childhood friend, Brooke. They're all college age now, and it appears they've kind of, not necessarily lost touch, but they don't see as much of each other as they used to, and there's a little bit of a strain there. Brooke has a roommate named Taylor, who has this sort of... Caddy has certain connotations, but it's not exactly a friction-free relationship with Natalie, because, you know, Taylor's the new friend and Natalie's the old friend. They can't be nice to one another, I guess. And then Brooke and Taylor's boyfriends, Quinn and Asher, respectively, which is the most obnoxious pair of douche bro names I think I've heard in a long time. We meet Quinn right away and Asher later. And then the final member of the crew is this very friendly, very little bit milk toasty, sort of handsome everyman character named Gavin, who Natalie is kind of nuts about, and turns out it's mutual because they all have to be coupled up. Anyway, Gavin is the one who secured them VIP passes to Hellfest. And so they go and meet him at the park. Meanwhile, as they're entering Hellfest, perspective changes, and we just see the back of a dude's head walking around for an interminable length of time. Just kind of walking around. He's not even wearing the mask or a hood at this point. It's just like brown hair on the back of a head.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually he puts on a mask, which we still haven't seen, and he tries to spook, again, a completely unrelated girl who's in the park, and she's just not having it, even more so than the girl in the opening. He's like, fuck off, basically, you're not scary, go away. And so he kind of gets a rage boner, I guess, and decides, okay, well, now she has to die.
Yeah, that seems like his MO.
Jason Voorhees hates camp counselors and premarital sex. This guy hates people who don't take haunted houses seriously. Yeah, who
just aren't feeling the Halloween spirit. The cardinal sin.
So, finally, we see the mask, and...
it just looks like a pile of potato skins.
It's really just...
dopey looking.
Really stupid. We immediately took to calling him Potato Face.
Yeah. We were alone in this in an otherwise empty theater, just to paint a picture.
So that was very convenient. So
we had a little bit of a low key Mystery Science Theater thing going on, as you do. We kept it to a minimum, you know,
but yeah.
Not trying to make a scene, but yeah, Potato Face became his informal appellation. It's actually better than what he's credited as at the end of the film, but we'll get to that when we get to it.
Yeah, we'll let you in on that at the end. So, Potato Face follows this girl who's not into it into
this Halloween Grinch.
How dare she?
Whose blood must be spilt to teach her the true meaning of...
of Spooktober.
Yeah, right.
And at this point, they cross paths with the main crew. Or at least the female members of the main crew. And at this point, she is no longer so disbelieving. She's bought it. She's terrified.
Well, she's running for her life.
Yeah, she realizes this guy wants to kill her at this point. And runs out in front of the three girls in the main crew. And, you know, starts yelling at them like, he's coming after me. Help. And they don't really do anything because they think it's part of the park.
She doesn't scream the first thing that anyone in that position would scream, which is, I swear to Christ, this is not a gag. This is not part of the haunted house. My name is such and such. I'm a real person. Please God help me. Instead, she just says kind of pat, like horror victim dialogue that sounds like something that an actor would say if this were a haunted house gag.
Right.
So naturally, they just look on in kind of muted delight
and
as she's butchered.
Yeah, he comes in, drags her out of her hidey hole, and just kind of like holds her on the ground, covers her mouth with his hand, and it just kind of stays that way for about 10 seconds, and then Taylor and Brooke decide, okay, well, this is getting a little much for us.
A little
we're gonna
too
leave
real. Gonna dip.
But Natalie's like just being all hardcore, and finally she says, well, go ahead and do it already. And Potato Face obliges her. And she seems to get a bad vibe from it, but she definitely does not make the logical leap like, oh wait, no, I just watched a real murder.
Mm-hmm.
She's just kind of freaked out. They exit the maze. There's a lot of wandering around. For a while, it just looks like a promo for Halloween Horror Nights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're sort of cavorting around. Eventually, Gavin and Natalie go off on their own, and they do cutesy couple stuff.
Yeah, they have a first kiss in a photo booth.
In a photo booth.
Very sweet.
Potato Face eventually shows up and steals the photos, which, okay, whatever. and when they're about to go into, like, the Mac Daddy, you know, maze, the one that's a big fucking deal, Gavin decides, well, you know, gall darn it, I never won Natalie a stuffed animal at the ring toss game. I have to go get her a stuffed animal.
This is a real chip on his shoulder. He spends a lot of time during their, like, courtship montage trying to win a stupid carnival huckster game.
And being just really athletically disinclined.
Yeah, really athletically disinclined and too proud to admit it, which neither, in tandem, a very unattractive quality. In a man.
At the same
time. It's a character who's otherwise very likable, but his defining characteristic is that he just won't let it fucking go. He needs that goddamn piece of shit carny doll that's going to fall apart in less than a week. Because it's like manufactured, you know, in some sweatshop and only made to look good in the dark.
Natalie doesn't seem to mind, though. Not really.
No, she thinks it's a gentlemanly gesture.
Right. So he runs off, and First he goes and asks the guy running the ring toss game, like, hey, I spent $50 here.
I hope to God is hyperbole, because good lord. Can you imagine if that sequence just played out unbroken as he slaps down dollar after dollar trying to hit those goddamn milk bottles or whatever they are?
In the original draft of Hellfest, Gavin just plays ring toss till dawn. Nobody dies.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, he goes back and tries to get the thing from the carny, and the carny's not having it. He's like, nah, bro, I could lose my job. And
it's a crazy thing to ask. It's like asking the casino for your money back.
Right. So Gavin goes off in search of some place he can steal stuffed animals, and sure enough, he finds one. We see this other carny emerge from some back room carrying a variety of stuffed animals, and then there's some off-screen dialogue where someone says, no, we got plenty of stuffed animals back in the locker, which is a totally unnecessary piece of dialogue. It's like, Gavin could have just intuited from the guy walking out, like, hey, there's probably more stuffed animals in there. Because we all made that logical leap, but no, we needed that signposted for us.
And the fact that it happened off-screen, you know, or emanated from off-screen, almost made it seem like they dubbed it in later. Because they, like, underestimated their audience that badly, which salted the wound.
Yeah, they cut the movie together and thought, like, you know, I don't know if this really comes across. We better drive it home. So Gavin goes in and he's rooting around in some cabinets trying to find stuffed animals. And he does, and Potato Face shows up and predictably kills him.
With a big, outsized, like, Harley Quinn hammer.
Right, which he uses to ring the bell in that classic carnival game. But the twist is, between the hammer and the strike plate for the bell is Gavin's head.
Yeah, it's just...
which gets
smashed crushed. Like a melon.
Yeah, smashed like a melon. Crushed into complete...
It's far and away the wackiest death in the movie. And easily. It's kind of front-loaded. So it's weird and very, like, you know, jokery. Or, like, Harley Quinn, as I already said. So this is not really... But it's not establishing a motif of wacky deaths to follow.
No.
It's kind of a weird outlier.
Yeah. Speaking of the Joker and Harley Quinn, I also observed during the movie that the entire place seems to be filled with green fog. It looked like...
Oh, like everybody's getting Joker toxin.
Yeah. Joker toxin everywhere. Rictus grins to come.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, so Gavin's dead. One down, five to go. The other five go on to this ride called Night Bumps, which I thought was funny. It's basically just like a Tunnel of Love sort of ride, but it's haunted.
It's like any ride at Disneyland where you just kind of strap in and off you go. It's on a track. Right. It's like a dark ride.
Natalie's cart gets stopped. She has a run-in with Potato Face. But then, as she comes out back into the entry area, there's a bunch of Potato Faces. And you're led to believe that, maybe this is going to be like a running thing. Like, they're going to make use of this. Either it's going to be, you know, a bunch of fake-outs, which would be tedious. Or, hey, maybe there are multiple people in on the murders.
Mm-hmm. Maybe some or all of the Potato Faces are up to no good.
But we'll go into that more later. What follows is a series of branching mazes that, you know, oh, big surprise, people get friggin' separated. Asher is off by himself. He eventually gets a needle to the eye from Potato Face. It's a very Fulci death.
It shows the syringe, you know, going in there. So I was impressed by that. I was surprised by that. It was bloodier than I'd anticipated.
Absolutely. After that, Natalie has a run-in with Potato Face in a bathroom. She gets stuck in a stall. He starts rattling the door, so she crawls under, goes into the next stall, and then just kind of stands there like he's not 2 feet to the left.
The second stall that she wiggles her way into is also mysteriously locked, which defies explanation.
I guess somebody just wanted to prank the bathroom. Crawled out themselves.
A fucking escape artist, yeah.
She gets out. They talk to a security guard, and he's basically like, oh, well, it's Hellfest. You came here to get scared. Did he actually hurt you? Nope. Okay, I'm leaving.
Wasn't actually brushing donut crumbs out of his beard, but might as well have been. Is your kind of classic incompetent cop character.
But then again, he's got a point.
Yeah, I mean, he's not wrong. They mishandle that scene because there's a whole... Well, I'm not going to get into that whole digression.
All right.
Speed things along here.
Sure. Then they go out, and finally we see Tony Todd, who's definitely the... marquee name in the film,
mm-hmm.
and as we predicted, he's only in the film for about 2 minutes, basically
glorified cameo appearance, although his voice shows up periodically doing announcements in the park. My favorite being when he says, "Thank you for your patience, we're having technical difficulties," but he still tries to say it in a scary way. Technical difficulties,
god bless Tony. It was just
he's really... Yeah, no, he was a light in the darkness on this one.
So he's basically there to come out on stage and do this big song and dance about, now you're getting into the real scary part of the park.
Yeah, he's kind of the master of ceremonies. He shows up to orchestrate a big set piece where someone is supposed to get fake guillotined in front of a crowd.
And the volunteer is Taylor, mm-hmm. our friend Taylor, as it happens. She and Tony Todd banter back and forth. And she gets fake guillotined at first, and Natalie recognizes the boots on the executioner as belonging to Potato Face.
Who's wearing a classic executioner hood at this point.
Right.
And big pack sack.
She's trying to run to the stage. She gets stopped by security, and then, you know, off rolls a very obviously fake head, and then we see that Taylor is fine. And like,
not soon enough, though. The movie drags out that reveal, even after it's apparent that... Like, it's all still happening in slow motion with scary music playing. Even, I mean, I guess the movie hasn't given you a real good long gander at the mannequin head, but at the moment it hits the ground, the moment it leaves her shoulders, it's obviously a charade. Right. But it's like they don't expect you to catch on just because the protagonist hasn't caught on. It's like, she's in the crowd, I'm watching the movie, I have a better vantage point than her. You know, I don't know why it's privileging her perspective over mine.
Who knows? So things get cleared out. Tony Todd leaves and all the staff are leaving. And one of them, like, points at Potato Face, like, "Hey, you got her? Can you let her out?" And Potato Face does a very solemn, slow nod. And it's like, "Okay, great." And he pieces out. And then rather than undoing the straps, he sort of...
tightens them.
Well, he shoves her ahead so that her... neck is actually in the guillotine slot, and then tightens her down, and she starts getting freaked out, which, you know, fair enough. At this point, he very dramatically takes off the executioner hood, under which is the Potato Face mask, which is a pretty amusing reveal.
Yeah, that was the biggest laugh the whole night. Just something about him removing one mask to reveal another is very farcical. It's like, how deep does this rabbit hole go, you know?
So Taylor's about to get real guillotined, and she does, but like ineffectually.
Because the blade is dull, because it's only meant to chop off mannequin heads.
Right.
Why it would be a real blade at all, I have no idea. That just seems like an accident waiting to happen.
Yeah.
It's a major liability. You'd think that the mannequin head would just be held on by Velcro or something if they're going to do this night after night.
Right, you would think.
Rather than, I don't know. But so the blade, this is like the most problematic scene in the movie for me. The blade like gets a good inch into the back of her neck, and she's like bludgeoned by it more than anything. And so then he slowly cranks it back up and gets ready to drop it again. She manages to extricate herself and kind of Houdini's out of there.
Right. And the other thing about it too is my initial expectation when it lands on her neck but doesn't chop her head all the way off is that it was gonna like leave her paralyzed.
Like, if you drop anything, like any heavy metal object on the back of someone's neck, then yeah, they're down for the count.
Right. So, you know, she should have been helpless and then...
Not guaranteed, but like in a movie, you'd think that was...
Yeah, a movie whose sole purpose is to kill all of its characters.
Right.
You know, you would take that classic opportunity, but and then she's just sort of panicked and unable to move until she actually dies. But instead, no, she gets free.
And she dies almost immediately after she escapes, which is, they just kind of drag it out unnecessarily in a way that I found a little leery and upsetting.
Yeah, she runs out, she meets up with Quinn and Brooke and Natalie, and then Taylor and Quinn are immediately double killed. in a sort of
in plain view of a crowd of people, and then everything just descends into shenanigans. All of a sudden, the jig is up, and they empty the park because he's just started massacring people like he's the protagonist of a Grand Theft Auto game. Yeah. You know, just going down the street, like no longer operating in the shadows.
And
like really, really kind of, I don't know how he was expecting to get out of that one.
And their deaths are so anticlimactic, too. After, you know, Gavin gets his cartoony carnival game death.
Ding!
And Asher gets his Fulci death. And Taylor nearly gets this very elaborate guillotine death.
Marie Antoinette.
Then she and Quinn just get quick stabbed out in the open, and then they're down. There's no
They just get shanked. Very unceremoniously.
So
one after another.
Once shit hits the fan, Natalie and Brooke are running away. They're trying to find the exit to the park. They're like, hey, look, this is an exit.
Yeah, Brooke goes, I think this is an exit. It's not an exit.
It is very clearly not an exit.
Patently, self-evidently not an exit. It's the entrance to a hell maze.
It's a demon's mouth with a hole in the middle. It's like a classic entryway. I don't know how she could have made that mistake.
Yeah, like if there had been a giant Cerberus guarding it, it could have not been any more apparent that it was a hellmouth.
And sure enough, they discover very quickly that, oh yeah, they've gone into the hell maze. And this sequence takes way too long. They're in there for like 15 minutes, and there's really never a lot of tension. They're basically just running, ducking, hiding from Potato
kind
Face.
A very protracted cat and mouse game where he gets the drop on them and then they get the drop on him.
And finally, they do get the drop on him, and Natalie somehow has gotten his knife and stabs him. And then they run off, and as they get back to the entrance to Hell Maze, the police are coming in. And Natalie's like, yeah, he's back there. But of course, the cops do not find him. The body is gone. We see where he was, and there's a patch of blood, but he's gone. So is the knife.
Cut to the obligatory scene of the police woman saying we can't find the body, we're still looking. Well, they're wrapped in those like itchy looking gray blankets that you always get when you're being consoled
by
police in a movie or in real life. I don't know.
I would assume probably real life. And then the final scene is we see this minivan driving through picturesque neighborhood,
just like yours or mine.
Over which is playing, you know, like a radio news report talking about the events of the rest of the movie.
Which incidentally gets the body count wrong.
Yeah, the radio news anchor says, you know, there were four fatalities, two of which were hidden away in mazes. And while...
I think it says five, and there's...
No, it's four.
Really?
It's definitely four.
Okay.
And there were four main characters that died, but there was also the initial girl that Natalie gave Potato Face permission to murder.
Yeah.
Now, you can make the argument that maybe the cops just haven't found the fifth body.
We don't
body
see
yet.
Him stashing it, so.
But yeah, we don't see him stashing it. It's kind of emblematic of how lazy and incompetent the rest of this movie is, that our first assumption is just like, oh yeah, no, they just forgot about her when they wrote that part of the script.
Yeah, there's an outside chance that we're wrong about this, but it speaks to our kind of disdain that we're not going to give them, we're not prepared to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Right. So the minivan pulls into this driveway, and we have a shot from behind someone that we assume is Potato Face.
Correctly.
And once again, like the rest of the movie, we never see his face, but he walks into this family living room, and there's a little girl asleep on the couch, you know, under a blanket, and she gets up.
The music at this point is like hitting a crescendo, like he's about to stab her to death or something. Like we're supposed to think he's a home invader and this is not his house, but it's clearly his house because it's preceded by a shot of him going into the basement and returning his potato mask to a wall of masks in a little cabinet. So it's like obviously he lives here, has like a little horror dungeon here, and then he goes upstairs.
And the girl wakes up, and of course, she's like, Daddy! And, you know, gets up and runs over and hugs him, and cut to another title card, Hellfest. That's it.
Roll credits, yeah. And it's like it's supposed to blow our minds. Like, wow, he's just like you or me. He's just an ordinary guy.
Man. Where is our country headed?
I gotta take stock. It's like the real monster is man.
The real monster was man all along.
Yeah, go figure.
And it's at this time that we discover that the name of Potato Face is, wait for it, The Other.
Yeah, that's how he's billed in the credits. How lame is that?
Which is excruciatingly lame.
A little too big for its fucking britches. You know, like, calling Michael Myers The Shape is pretty cool. Like, that's you know, it was a long time ago. Nowadays, just, if they don't have a name, just call them The Killer or something. Please, please don't try to assign them something cool, because all the cool ones have been taken.
Or just fucking lean into it and call him Potato Face, you know?
There's branding potential there, man.
Yeah, I mean,
call,
you know,
us.
If they made a film called Pumpkinhead, you can make one called Potato Face.
Yeah, I rather like Pumpkinhead. Well, I like Stan Winston. You know, special effects in that movie are very good.
They are good. Anyway, well, now that we've laid out the plot, I think we can go ahead and take our break, and then we'll come back and kind of elaborate on what we didn't like about this movie and what we would do to fix it. So we'll be back in a moment.
Are you ready to enter the depths of hell?
Hey guys, Jim here during the break to let you in on some ways you can help support our podcast. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Got an idea for the next movie you'd like us to fix? Feel free to send us a DM on social media, or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
You came here to be scared, right? I can't arrest people for doing their job. Welcome to Hellfest.
And we're back.
Welcome. So, Matt, what beefs did you have with Hellfest?
So, I'm going to front load the one major positive, which is that aesthetically, or like cinematographically, this movie is impressive to look at points. It's got, you know, at times it does look like a promo for like Hollow Weekends at Cedar Point or something or something like that. But you know, it has a lot of bold primary colors. It's kind of a giallo aesthetic. At least that's how it struck me during the prologue. It gets samey towards the end because they spend 90% of this movie in myriad haunted houses. So there's a lot of red and green lights kind of diffused through walls of mist. And that's all nice to look at.
Yeah,
you
there
know?
Were...
It's sort of a sensory overload, which is a whole lot better than like the drab color palette in Slender Man. And even a little bit more eye-catching than The Nun, although The Nun had a much more impressive location. That also kind of got samey towards the end. So just relative to what we've already covered, it's not a bad looking movie.
No. And there was one couple of shots that I remember near the middle of the film when Natalie has broken down on her Night Bumps ride where all the lights get shut off and then it's just a red light.
Yeah, just a red strobe.
First we see, like, looming in the distance just the shape of Potato Face, and we don't see the mask so much, which is a big bonus. and then it cuts to just, there's a little patch of the red light that's on Natalie's eyes and forehead.
Oh, I remember that.
And that whole set of, like, three or four shots is probably the best looking that this movie gets, and it's legitimately nice to look at.
Yeah, there's one overhead shot of the park near the beginning that's the most Joker toxin-y shot. That was also rather nice, I thought. That just showed a lot of nondescript figures kind of moving through a green haze. That was pretty impressive. So, you know, lots of neon, lots of what you'd expect from a haunted house.
Right.
So it definitely capitalizes on that aesthetic.
Yeah, and so basically what we're getting at is that the movie is not without technical chops, at least mm-hmm. from a visual perspective.
Yeah, when I described it as Houses October built with a budget, that's, you know, narratively virtually identical. It's just nicer. It's easier on the eyes. It's not going to make you nauseous if you don't like found footage movies. It's you know, competently assembled in that respect. Biggest beef, far and away, right out the gate, is that the killer is extremely boring. He keeps doing all of his body language, all of his mannerisms is just ripped straight from Nick Castle in the original Halloween. He keeps doing the Michael Myers head tilt, the way he, you know, he'll cock his head to one side when he's looking at his victims, kind of like a curious bird almost, or like a velociraptor. But that, it's just so played out at this point. Like Michael Myers, I fully expect him to do that in the, you know, the movie we'll be covering for our next episode in all likelihood. But that's fine. That's classic. There's a sort of tradition.
Yeah, I mean, that's a callback. That's not a ripoff.
Right, yeah, but this is just this potato-y motherfucker just chomping someone else's style. And I almost thought, you know, especially since they try to blow your mind at the end by going, he's just a regular dude, that the implication was supposed to be that he's someone who's just watched a lot of horror movies and is aping what he's seen on the TV, which is also kind of a, you know...
It would have been played out, but at least it would have had more substance.
Given
than
him
this.
A more of an MO, yeah, more of a reason. What's the French expression? Raison d'être.
Yeah,
I always butcher French or any language other than my native tongue.
Yeah,
so I'm an ignorant American.
We're not really speaking French speakers.
Speaking of words that I routinely butcher, the killer's leitmotif is what?
Leitmotif.
That wasn't even a joke. Okay. His theme music is Pop Goes the Fucking Weasel. He is constantly not even humming, just kind of muttering Pop Goes the Weasel under his breath. He'll be going around the park going like But even that has like a little bit more musicality than the way that he does it. It's just not at all scary. It's chronically ridiculous. And the movie never recovers from it.
No, he even does this at the end when he like walks into his living room to find his daughter, which is the dumbest thing.
Uh-huh.
It cannot both serve as the thing he does to scare his victims and also the cutesy thing he does with his daughter.
Uh-huh.
I mean, maybe a more capable film would have pulled off having that do double duty, and that could have been creepy.
If his daughter had been a little bit younger, it might have worked. If she'd been like nursery rhyme age, it would have made sense. But she looked like 11, maybe.
I don't know about that old, but certainly like
nine to nine or ten, yeah. Let's say. So any 9 or 10 year old that I've ever met would have woken up on that couch and gone like, "Oh, Dad, you're so weird. What are you doing? Why are you just looming over me and murmuring Pop Goes the Weasel?" In, you know, a blood-stained hoodie that you're still wearing. I don't know, maybe he's like, has a whole murder family, but that's not the vibe I got.
Absolutely
from that scene,
not.
That it's like a Texas Chainsaw thing. I don't think that he's like training her to follow in his footsteps.
No.
It's a like weird sequel hook for a sequel we'll likely never get.
Oh, absolutely not. He's also, and I touched on this a little bit during the synopsis, but he's also dull in that he doesn't have any, you know, motivation of any kind. He doesn't have any personality. He's just kind of there. I mean, Michael Myers, he doesn't have a lot of personality in terms of...
Yeah, he's a vacuity. That's the whole point of his character.
Right, but he does at least
have... At least they commit to it.
Right, and he also has the backstory established at the beginning of the film of... Yeah, he murdered his whole fucking family. And
when he was a child.
When he was a child.
He's a bad egg. He's a bad seed.
We have Donald Pleasance like reinforcing that throughout the whole movie.
And
like,
really, really selling that idea every opportunity he gets.
Because thank God for Donald Pleasance.
Yes. And thank God for Tony Todd. If he'd been in the Donald Pleasance role, they could have done something with this.
They could have made something out of this. And as I said, you know, Jason Voorhees hates camp counselors and premarital sex. Ghostface and Scream.
To be clear, because camp counselors were screwing when he drowned.
Right.
Or were, like, fucking off and not doing their jobs.
Ghostface from Scream likes to do creepy phone calls.
And he specifically quizzes people on horror movies. Like, there's always a gimmick. There's always a specific gimmick. And yeah, that's just missing here.
Entirely missing. Literally the only thing that makes Potato Face recognizable is his potato face, which, again, is not scary, yeah, thoroughly forgettable.
No, the mask sucks. And when he opens his mask cabinet at the end, you see, like, an array of masks, all of which are more interesting looking than the one he's been wearing the whole movie. Now, some of them are taken. In fact, all of them might be a reference to something. I only noticed two. There was the Onibaba one,
mm-hmm,
and then there was one hanging in the top left that was the face of the alien creatures in the Twilight Zone episode Eye of the Beholder, which is the one where the lady is recuperating from facial reconstructive surgery in the hospital and she's all bandaged up.
Mm-hmm.
Beauty's in the Eye of the Beholder.
Right.
That's the, you know, you can see the twist coming a mile away. Fucking love the Twilight Zone. So if he'd gone around the whole movie wearing that, that would have been a bold move.
But no, just potato face.
Yeah, just potato face. Not mashed potatoes, mind you. Like potato skins. Like just like a kind of brownish morass.
Yeah, just not much there. Something that bothered me is that with the haunted house gimmick, in theory, this movie had the opportunity to make use of as many creepy locations and horror tropes as possible. It could have been a really fun, like, mashup, almost. It could have really gotten a lot of traction.
Kind of a greatest hits thing, yeah.
Right, and could have taken some of the best elements of various sorts of horror films and used those for effective scares. But it really did feel so much of the time like it was just somebody, I mean, obviously not visually, because again, it's not found footage, but it basically, narratively, and the impression you get looks like somebody followed this group of teenagers, or I guess they're not teenagers, they're college kids, but whatever, followed them around with a camera while they went through a horror thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no... The jump scares don't even work as jump scares. We talked about in The Nun how there's a lot of jump scares just for jump scares' sake, and they're not really used as effectively as they could be or as they ought to be. But they still, I still jumped.
Occasionally, yeah.
Occasionally, like not always, but some of the time. In Hellfest, no. At no point was I even the slightest bit scared, concerned, tense. Just nothing. I got no emotional reaction out of it at all, and yeah. I don't think you did either.
Well, it's like going through five haunted houses in a row. It just becomes kind of deadening after a certain point. I don't know, you just acclimate to it. There's only so many times that something can jump out at you. And I think that that's even by design. Like, you see the characters in the movie getting jaded. As, you know, by the time they make it to the end of the first haunted house, they're, like, pointing at, oh, that one's not a mannequin. That's the one that's going to jump. You know, it's kind of played for laughs. So it almost feels like it's not trying to scare you, but it's not making you feel anything else either.
Yeah, no, it's that could be a sort of, like, vaguely interesting metatextual thing if they went anywhere with it.
Yeah,
but no, it's the characters have become bored and now we are too.
Right, because it's just a parade of jump scares without consequence.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, could have been a kind of wry criticism of its competitors in the horror scene these days, but it really, yeah, it doesn't land that way. I think it's really just supposed to, I don't know, because the closest thing that the killer has to a motivation, which we already talked about, is that he has a hankering for the blood of people who aren't feeling, who aren't jumping, basically. So he wants to stab them, you know, see the fear in their eyes where before there was none. So I guess our protagonists have to get bored in order to become his prey, which is, I don't know, it's not enough of a motivation for me to get invested in this guy and his murder quest.
Right. And it's also a heavy price to pay to, like, suck all the life out of a movie for 45 minutes before
yes.
people start getting killed. It's just, there's not enough lead in.
Yeah. the characters too, again, I said this in the Slender Man episode, it's true here too, the banter between them is really bad, pretty much without exception. There was one line that I liked, although I don't know that it's worth recounting. It's sort of a had-to-be-there thing,
right,
that made me chuckle in a good way, where one of the guys, like, reacts to one of the performers in a haunted house, goes like, he startled me, or she, I don't know which, and she goes like, yeah, how dare you assume, in a way that, like, felt like something like an actual millennial joke about being woke. It's like, right, the kind of joke that I might imagine an actual flesh and blood 20 something making in that situation. It was the only line that registered that way authentically for me the whole movie. All the rest of it was all just, I don't know, bland, and then the line readings themselves kind of became intensely grating to me, because I got the impression that it was a bunch of, you know, young, hungry actors overcompensating for what they knew was, or maybe they were being directed to behave this way, I don't know. They were either using their own instincts, or the director was goading them into performing a certain way. In any case, they were overcompensating for a bad script by just doing a lot of, like, funny voices and like kind of like singing a lot of the lines a little bit. Like, every line felt like it should have been accompanied by finger guns, I think, is the best way that I can describe it. Yeah, every single line in the first act of this movie, the first half of it practically, is like, you know, I'm just joshing you, I'm just, you know, that kind of inflection, but just applied ubiquitously across every single line.
Yeah, the number of times that Gavin has to say to the other dudes, like, oh yeah, thanks you guys, that wasn't weird or anything.
That wasn't awkward at all, yeah.
It's like, yeah, okay, we get it, haha. Yeah, you're the nervous guy who's not in a committed relationship.
And then Natalie, is that her name?
Yes.
The girl, the protagonist, who he's wooing, is in the mold of the traditional slasher protagonist, in that she's kind of the shy, virginal one who's doesn't really want to be there. It would rather be studying. There's even allusion to that at one point. Well, some of us have a scholarship that we have to, you know.
Yeah, that's in the intro scene.
It's so tropey, and obviously deliberately, because the Hellfest is kind of a half-assed entry in this sort of 80s nostalgia renaissance that we're all living through right now. It's not really billed that way, not to the same degree as, like the It remake went all in on that stuff and made just a fuck billion dollars as a result.
A fuck billion.
Hellfest is more like, once it starts playing, you go like, oh, this is an 80s throwback, but it wasn't really marketed that way.
Right. It wasn't really marketed at all, to be fair. Like,
yeah, it's true.
I saw the trailer, I think, twice. I didn't see any posters for it. I didn't see any banner ads for it. I keep my eye out for these things because, you know, if nothing else, we're doing a podcast.
This is our media.
I don't know. It definitely doesn't make a lot out of the 80s throwback kind of vibe. It doesn't really embrace, but is sort of faintly there throughout.
Yeah, it's just sort of 80s adjacent.
Yeah. Because, for example, I rather enjoyed the It remake.
Yeah.
I thought it was quite entertaining.
I liked it well enough.
And, as you say, it really leaned into that and made a fuck billion dollars, which is distinct from a regular billion, apparently.
Yeah, right. It's actually a little less.
As in, if we almost made $1 billion.
Yeah.
Dollars.
Yeah, if we're being pedants, then, you know, they didn't actually clear $1 bill at the box office.
The other thing that bothered me about it is just that the movie's got, like, one trick in its bag of tricks, and that's, nobody believes it's real. Mm-hmm. Nobody thinks these murders are really happening.
And I've complained before about how much I hate that contrivance. So,
yeah.
I don't even need to tell you how tedious that was.
Like, that's tedious, but also, it doesn't really do anything with that. Again, even in movies where that whole trope is very trite and played out, and the only reaction it would get out of, say, Matt is sort of angry grumbling in the corner, this movie didn't even do that. Like, there was no There was no tension. There was no frustration. Like, oh, come on, really?
Yeah.
It just kind of happened. I just kind of watched a thing that didn't really do much. It didn't even make the most out of an already tired trope can't get much.
And that's the worst kind. That's the worst way to implement that trope is when it just feels like the movie is spinning its wheels. You know, just killing time the way that Potato Face kills teenagers.
Very slowly.
Yeah, slowly and indiscriminately, yeah. with no mercy.
I don't know. Was there anything else that bugged you about this movie?
I don't know. I mean, I feel slightly warmer towards it than you did. Like Jim was vibrating a little bit on our way out of the theater. Like, he's really had his time wasted. I felt like it reminded me of, let me think. Do you remember watching a movie with me a couple of years ago called Girl House?
Yeah.
It was not better or worse than Girl House.
You see, I thought it was worse than Girl House.
Okay, so. Fine. I don't think very highly of Girl House, if that's not apparent. It just goes on the pile of movies that I probably could have done without ever having seen, but have now seen. I will say, though, there were... So, this is going to be a weird little rant. There's a particular kind of malaise that can creep into your spirit, I think, when you're watching a horror movie that's bad in just the right way. I remember being really young, well, I was 12 maybe, and watching bits and pieces. I kept changing the channel, but I was watching bits and pieces of a Friday the 13th marathon on AMC. Which was channel 46 on my TV. And one of them, either 4 or 5, I'm willing to bet, maybe you remember because we watched them again more recently, but I still don't know, has a scene where this dude is about to shit his pants. He's like having diarrhea and he like jumps into a porta potty and is then impaled through the wall of the porta potty by like a spear or some other sharp implement by Jason Voorhees, and he just dies on the toilet. And I remember watching that as a kid and thinking, like, this is the most depressing thing I've ever watched. Like, this is the saddest, most dismal, like, shittiest, you know, no pun intended, way to go. Like, it's just... And there was a moment in this movie when some of that crept back in, which was when the lady was having her head incompetently decapitated when she's strapped into the guillotine. I thought that, you know, it was just long and drawn out and depressing.
Kind of how I felt about the film Martyrs.
Yeah, I mean, Martyrs...
It has more going for it, certainly. Yeah. But just, like, in terms of feeling, like you said, a malaise set in, like, God, this is just...
At least that's the feeling that Martyrs is going for. Like, yeah. It's pushing the envelope and trying to make you feel like a piece of shit. Whereas... I think movies like this or like a Friday the 13th sequel want you to have a good time.
Right.
And so then when they make you feel bad, you know that you're being made to feel bad by incompetence, and you don't feel, and that feeling of not being in good hands, not being like shepherded through an experience that's crafted to make you feel a certain way. I don't know. It just makes me feel like I'm being, I don't know, like something's gone awry somewhere.
Yeah, I'm on board with you. So, what do we do? What do we do if we're going to try and fix this thing?
Jesus. Well, you got to axe Pop Goes the Weasel, first things first.
Absolutely.
If I could, again, make only one change, that's it. No theme, musical theme, would be better than that one. Which is to say that having none would be better than having that one.
Right. I think also that, I don't know whether it would be better or worse necessarily, but I think the filmmakers could have kept in mind the fact that the killer himself does not necessarily need to be the one presenting his own leitmotif.
You know, that's true. That's true. You know, we don't all have to be Peter Lorre in M. You know, he can have, like, Michael Myers isn't wandering the streets going under his breath.
Right.
Spooking trick-or-treaters.
Which would have been the dumbest.
Strictly for the audience's benefit.
Yeah, and so it could be playing over the soundtrack, and it, in all likelihood, would work better that way.
Well, not if it's Pop Goes the Weasel.
Well, yeah, there's no helping Pop Goes the Weasel.
No, but, it's hopeless.
Yeah, so that would be a good first
step. Actually, just kind of kept reminding me of, especially when it was, when it seemed like it was going to precede a jump scare, mm-hmm. like when you heard it just kind of sourceless, like when the, Brooke, is that her name? When it looks like Brooke is about to get got. Near the beginning, mm-hmm. and you just hear, but you don't know, you don't see him.
Right.
It just reminded me of that scene in Elf when Will Ferrell is testing the Jack in the Box, waiting for it to spring out at him.
Jesus.
Which is just like the most, I mean, that's a jump scare. It's actually a more effective jump scare. Than anything in Hellfest. Yeah, Elffest. That's the mashup that I'm holding out for.
All right, I'll cut together a trailer.
Yeah, but that's as cold and mechanical as a jump scare can possibly get. Just turning that handle, waiting for it to jump out and spook you.
It reminds me of how Potato Face literally is turning a handle at one point in this film.
Yeah, during the scene that sent me into a weird reverie about Friday the 13th and my misspent childhood watching a lot of shitty movies on AMC.
Back when AMC used to play a lot more shitty movies, mm-hmm. now they just play shitty zombie TV shows.
Mm-hmm. Hot take.
Hot take. Coming in hot. yeah. Another thing that I might have suggested is that, you know, they pull the gag of, look, it's multiple guys in the Potato Face mask when Natalie's getting off of the Night Bumps ride, and then they proceed to do almost literally nothing with it. There is one bit during the climax when the cops have showed up and people are running pell-mell, and the cops or security or whatever finds a guy in a Potato Face mask and tackles him to the ground. And, you know, we think, oh, maybe he's been caught. And then they pull off the mask and they linger on his face for a really long time, which is also silly because we've never seen Potato Face's face. But anyway, it pans down to his shoes, which are his most identifying characteristic other than the mask. Mm-hmm. And they're different shoes, so it's not Potato Face. Other than that, the multiple masked bad guy or potential bad guy device never resurfaces again. Not once.
When it's first introduced, they milk it a little bit because there's the one perched like a gargoyle on top of her cart when she emerges from Night Bumps. Because he menaces her during the technical difficulties, as Tony Todd would put it. I don't have his timbre, unfortunately.
No, we all should be so lucky.
Yes.
So we've got these multiple guys wearing these masks, and obviously if all but one were just, oh, it's not actually a bad guy, it's just a red herring, that would have been dumb, because that's been done to death.
Yes, it has.
But... and this is what I thought might happen back when I was more inclined to give this film credit, you know, mm-hmm. before I had finished watching it. I thought that potentially there would be multiple murderers, you know, like Scream, for example. There's mm-hmm. two ghost faces who are in on it.
Spoilers.
If you haven't watched Scream by now and you're listening to this podcast, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, fair enough.
Anyway, I thought there would be potentially multiple killers. Mm-hmm.
I was hoping they'd go that direction. Honestly, the only twist that I want to say is a bold claim, but I think almost every twist that hinges on the idea that there's been a sinister cult at play, you know, the whole time, it almost always works for me. I just fucking love murder cults more than anything. So the idea that there's like a group of Potato Faces, not all of them necessarily, but like a cabal of secret murderers has sought gainful employment in a traveling horror show, and every year they just pick off a couple people that nobody's gonna miss.
Right.
That's a scary notion.
Yeah. As a trope, I also like murder cults. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like how I like exorcism movies. You don't have to try that hard to get me on board with a murder cult. But yeah, they definitely don't go that route, and I really think they should have, because mm-hmm. it would have number one, it would have given Potato Face as an entity, you know, more flavor, more of a backstory. Instead, it's just, I mean, yeah, okay, he's still got a backstory. He, you know, kills people, and sometimes he leaves them as part of the haunted house.
And he's just a regular guy, just like you or me. Wow.
Every time you put on that voice, I just think of Randy Marsh.
I wasn't deliberately.
Oh my God.
I wasn't deliberately invoking Randy Marsh, but I can see where you got that from.
Yeah, no, it kind of works. Still, it would have given the film at least a jumping off point from there. I don't know where they would have necessarily taken dealing with a murder cult, but given the film's runtime and the fact that there's like a 15-minute cat and mouse game, you probably could have taken out a bunch of that and fit in a murder cult confrontation.
Yeah, because without that, he really, I can't stress this enough, he really is just Michael Myers with no backstory and a worse mask. Right down to his body going missing when you think that he's dead, and then the cops arrive on the scene and he's gone. And Halloween, that's really chilling, partly because it's accompanied by the music.
Right.
And then that, like, brilliant sequence of just, like, empty, unlit lawns and hallways and, you know, with his breathing. He could be anywhere. That's the, you know, see, that's the sequel hook.
God, I miss John Carpenter.
Yeah, well, he's not dead yet.
He's not dead, but he doesn't make movies anymore.
I think he contributed to the soundtrack for the new one. At least he got credit. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, no, he does. He still does music, and that's good. Mm-hmm. I'm glad he does, but he's not making movies anymore.
All right, that's early. I thought maybe he died and I hadn't heard about it.
No, no.
That would have been upsetting.
But anyway, we're getting off track. Once again, no personality to Potato Face, and, you know, maybe having a murder cult attached to him would have helped.
From a standpoint of trying to be constructive, I would say Ditch Pop Goes the Weasel, and really just... So horror movies always kind of tread this tightrope where they want you to like the characters so that you fear for them, but they don't want to make them too likable because then it would be upsetting when they get ripped to pieces.
Right.
So a lot of characters in slasher movies are by design one-dimensional disposable shitheads. They're either like fratty dude bros or, you know, like kind of ditzy bimbo kind of stock characters. And none of the characters in this movie are, well, the lady who almost gets decapitated is pretty obnoxious.
Yeah.
There, I mean, and the pair of dudes with the ridiculous names.
And what are Quinn they called? Quinn and Asher.
Asher and Donner and Blitzen. Yeah. You're not meant to care about them. But some horror movies do that tightrope walk better than others. This one bungles it pretty badly, I think, because actually the little courtship between Natalie and Gavin is kind of sweet, and they overplay it. You know, they overplay their hand a little bit with both of them being shy and awkward. You know, it's a lot of the same. But right as they're starting to fall into each other's arms is when they get separated. And then he's promptly splatted on a, what do they call those things? Hammer time.
Yeah, no, the hammer bell game.
Yeah, that right.
I mentioned during the synopsis.
The strength test, I think it's always called. So yeah. Then that just, you know, nothing comes of that. And he was far and away at least the most likable male character. So right. I guess that they're trying to subvert your expectations by killing him off first and not having his burgeoning relationship ever bear fruit. But it backfired pretty badly for me because then you're just left with a bunch of people that you like less than a corpse.
Right. Yeah. As these characters are constructed, I think if they had gone the more conventional route of keeping Gavin alive for longer, having him stay with Natalie and having them struggling through this situation together at least for longer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, leaving Brooke and Natalie is the last two alive still works. But
yeah, well, they've got like best friend necklaces, I guess. That's a thing that's alluded to once or twice.
And, you know, maybe Gavin dies semi-heroically at the end, or at least very dramatically at the end. Again, obviously that's played out, but I think as these characters have been designed, that would have worked better than what they did.
Yeah, I mean, I like Well, conceptually, I like the idea of rather than being a final girl movie, there's two final girls protecting each other. That's kind of neat. I don't think I've ever actually seen that before. So I'm on board with that. I was just kind of over the movie at that point.
Yeah.
It had run out of steam depleted my goodwill. And again, I like it a little bit better than you did, and I still felt pretty fatigued by that final cat and mouse hunt. So I guess my advice is, if you make all of the characters likable, then your audience is completely in the dark as to who's going to live and who's going to die. Like, I think of all the slasher movies I've seen, the original Texas Chainsaw might have done this the best. I couldn't tell you most of those characters' names, but they're all pretty, they seem like pretty down-to-earth, chill people.
I don't know, Franklin is pretty awful.
Yeah, Franklin sucks. And he's like a paraplegic, which is so un-PC and so great. Like, you'd never, he's like the most dickhead guy in a wheelchair in movie history. So, yeah, no, Franklin's an asshole. But the Texas sucks. I would be that guy on a road trip in Texas in the middle of the summer.
Especially if you were stuck in a wheelchair. No, yeah. I get it. So yeah, they all...
I'd just be sweating my ass off. And he's always getting left behind. I kind of feel for Franklin. But he's been dragged there by his sister. Like, he's not coming here to party and get laid, So
fair enough. But yeah, as you say...
Texas Chainsaw, those dominoes could have fallen in any order. There's no telling, because none of them seems more disposable than the other.
Right.
So if that should be like your Bible as far as like writing your characters. Don't make some of them, more or less real than the others.
Because then you can sketch out the whole thing in advance.
Yeah.
And we nearly did. Like, if I had to guess, it probably would have gone down mostly the same as it did, except Gavin would have died...
That was the
fourth rather than first.
That was the one curveball that the movie throws. Yeah.
Well, you got anything else for us?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean...
Fix your mask. Fix your leitmotif. Nailed it. Which is how they would have said it in this movie. They would have kind of sung it like that.
Leitmotif.
And then like, nailed it!
Yeah.
I want to just kind of wash this movie out of my hair.
Yeah, I think as... Matt's been alluding to, I just didn't get a lot out of this movie at all, so it's hard for me to think of ways to perk it up and to reconstruct it.
Colors.
Yeah.
Pretty, it had that going for it. And I think Jim was right, what you said earlier about how there should have been more variety in the haunts that they went through. The first one had a pretty coherent theme. I think they called it Deform School, which is pretty funny.
Yeah.
Where it's just like a school for like corpses and mutants. But the whole thing is like, they're going down a hallway and it's all lockers and classrooms and things like that. None of the other haunted houses had a discernible motif.
After that, it's just a complete hodgepodge.
Yeah, they all just kind of blur together. And the characters make a big to-do about how they're getting deeper and deeper into the serious part of the park.
We don't get that impression.
No, it's not. They almost like frame it as like a Heart of Darkness kind of journey where they're like every haunt is supposed to be scarier than the one preceding it until they make it to hell, basically.
So I guess the one final piece of advice I have is that if that's going to be the line you're sticking to, that they start with the soft stuff and then go into the creepier.
Then
the
you
creepier.
Have to actually ramp it up.
You have to do it, not accidentally do it backwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for Christ's sake, axe that epilogue. That really soured me on the whole thing in a way that I think I was would have been a kinder review if it had not been for those final 8 seconds of her waking up and going, Daddy!
Yeah.
Mind equals blown.
Mind equals thoroughly unshook.
Yeah.
Well, this has been another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Jarendaisy. Just remember, the real horror is being alive.
We'll see you next time.
On that note.
Thanks for listening. Before we go, I'd like to make some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Hellfest teaser trailer HD, uploaded by CBS Films. All rights reserved. Our next episode, discussing the long-awaited Halloween reboot, will be up on Sunday, October 28th. See you then.